Last week we discussed Genesis 25, and I emphasized, I think, several times in that chapter just how pivotal and important that chapter is. Because in that chapter we saw the birth of Jacob and Esau. And if you recall, we discussed about how this wrestling match they were in inside Rebekah's womb was a portent of a bigger wrestling match, one that we all have. It's the wrestling match between the flesh and the spirit. And I hope that you won't forget the things we talked about last week. And in fact, this chapter, chapter 26, which always to me has been just a very lopsided, odd kind of chapter. Some chapters are just smooth from beginning to end, like the Akedah in Genesis 22. It's just wonderful. Genesis 1, you have the creation. It's just, everything just flows. And you come to this chapter, it seems lumpy. It's like they didn't stir it enough. And but we're going to find out that this chapter emphasizes what we talked about last week. So let's just jump right into it. Genesis 26, verse 1. There was a famine in the land, aside from the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. If you recall, back in those days, in Abraham's days, there was a famine. And then where did Abraham go in that famine? Went to Egypt, right? And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, to Gerar. Adonai appeared to him and said, "Do not descend to Egypt and dwell in the land that I shall indicate to you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your offspring will I give all these lands and establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will increase your offspring like the stars of the heavens, and will give to your offspring all these lands. And all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your offspring. Because Abraham obeyed my voice, guarded my safeguards, or observed my safeguards, my mitzvot, my commandments, my decrees, and my Torahs, my instructions." So we see God kind of renewing the covenant with Isaac that he had made with Abraham. Now he tells him, don't go to Egypt. And the rabbis and the Midrash Rabbah have a really interesting insight into that. You know, in the Torah, it says that when you bring an olah offering, which is the highest kind of offering to God, that when you take the meat of that, you have to eat the meat within the tabernacle precincts or within the temple precincts. You can't take the meat of the olah offering outside the curtains or outside the walls of the tabernacle or the temple courtyard. Well, you remember back in Genesis 22, God told Abraham, take your son, your only one, whom you love, Isaac, and bring him up as an olah to me. And they say, based on this, Isaac was not allowed to leave the land of Israel because he's an olah offering. He must stay in the holy land. You understand? I think it's a beautiful picture. But regardless, he was told to stay put. And so we see in verse 6, so Isaac settled in Gerar. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister." For he was afraid to say, "My wife." Quote, "Lest the men of the place kill me because of Rebekah, for she is fair to look upon," unquote. So we've seen this before, haven't we? In fact, this is the third time we've seen this happen. When Abraham, during that first famine, went to Egypt, as they approached Egypt, he told Sarah, "Sarah, listen, they look at you, they're going to want you, so they're going to kill me to take you, so just say, you're my sister." Later, when Abraham, for whatever reason, went to Gerar, he told her the same thing. Say, you're my sister. And now here's Isaac telling Rebekah, "Rebekah, this is how we do it in our house, in our family. I learned this from Dad. Just say you're my sister." And we get all kind of, it's just kind of weird when you look at that, how that works. What are they doing? Now, Sarah was actually technically a sister to Abraham. because they descended from the same father, but not from the same mother. She was more like a cousin. But Rebekah and Isaac, they were distant cousins, but which makes them, in Hebraic thought, brother-sister, kind of. But still, why this ploy? Why do we see this over and over again? I think what we can do, we can get distracted by asking, why do they do this? And what's the purpose of these guys doing this to their wives? I think what God would have us do instead is look at the bride. Look at the bride, because the bride, Sarah in the first case, Rebecca in this case, is always a picture of the bride, of Messiah, bride, us. And when we do that, we discover something interesting. If you look at all three cases, you're going to find that each time the king of the place, Pharaoh, and in this case, Abimelech, came to the realization that this is a married woman. But they each came to that realization in a completely different way. With the first time, when Abraham went to Egypt during the famine, how did Pharaoh come to realize, this is a married woman? This isn't Abraham. So this is Abraham's wife. How did he realize that? Well, in Genesis 12:17 says, but Adonai struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So God sent plagues against Pharaoh and his household because he had taken Sarah as away from Abraham. What does this remind you of? Can you think of another time when God's bride was in Egypt and Pharaoh was mistreating her and God brought all kinds of plagues? Right? Yeah. Over in Exodus, the next book, when the Israelites are in Egypt and the Egyptians and Pharaoh enslave them, mistreat them, and then God sends Moses, sends the plagues to let Pharaoh know in no uncertain terms, these people are mine, they are not yours. In fact, in Exodus 11, verse 1, says, now Adonai said to Moses, one more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. In other words, when this last plague comes, he's going to realize, all right, these folks I can't hold on to. I have to let them go back to their husband, to their bridegroom, back to God. Okay, you see that? Now, before we look at the next one, where Abraham and Sarah go to Gerar, the same place where Isaac and Rebekah are now, you remember how God revealed to Abimelech that Sarah was actually Abraham's husband? Do you remember what happened? I know it's only a few chapters ago, but as slow as we've been going, it's been months since we went over it. So that was back in Genesis chapter 20. It says, but God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you've taken, for she is married. And it goes on, then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this. In other words, you did not realize she was a married woman. And I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, there's some interesting things here. He says, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart. You didn't know better. And he says, I kept you from sinning against me. God also tells Abimelech, I did not let you touch her. So he's saying, Abimelech, I've been operative in your house. I've been operative in your life, and you didn't even know it. In fact, I'm sending you this dream, telling you this stuff right now. But this is your chance to act. And if you act, you live. If you don't act properly, you die. Your call. So we see a king where God's operating in his life, and the king has no idea. He has no idea of the wrong he has done or almost about to do, and has no idea that God has been preventing him from doing certain things. He has no idea that God is protecting this woman that he has taken into his house. He has no idea about any of this. And this reminds me of the second exile Israel went in. They were exiled to Egypt in Genesis, but later they were exiled again. Where were they exiled to the next time? It was for 70 years. Who remembers? Yeah, to Babylon. Do you remember how they came out of Babylon? It's a wonderful, wonderful story. They go to Babylon, and while they are there, and the whole story of Daniel, he's there, and Nebuchadnezzar and all of that, while they are there during that period of time, Babylon is overthrown by Media-Persia. We'll just say Persia to make it simple. And over time, God raises up a new king, a Persian king over Babylon, whose name is Cyrus. And you can read it about it in the last part of Isaiah 44, and then all of Isaiah 45. In fact, let's turn there for a second. I want you to see something. I love this section of Scripture. When people get into a discussion with you, read argument, about God's sovereignty, this is where you can go. Go to Isaiah 44, verse 24. Isaiah 44, 24. Thus says Adonai, your Redeemer, and the one who formed you from the womb. I, Adonai, am the maker of all things, stretching out the heavens by myself, spreading out the earth all alone, causing the omens of boasters to fail, making fools out of diviners, causing wise men to draw back and turning their knowledge into foolishness, confirming the word of his servant, performing the purpose of his messengers. It is I who says of Jerusalem, you shall be inhabited, and of the cities of Judah, they shall be built, and I will raise up her ruins again. It is I who says to the depth of the sea, be dried up, and I will make your rivers dry. It is I who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. He will perform all my desire. Now, here's the interesting thing. This was written about Cyrus 100 years before Cyrus was born. God names Cyrus by name, says Cyrus is my shepherd. He'll do exactly what I want him to do. He doesn't know me, doesn't know anything about me, but he's going to do my will. Go to chapter 45, the next verse, verse 1. Thus says Adonai to Cyrus, his anointed, whom I have taken by the right hand to subdue nations before him, to loose the loins of kings, to open doors before him so that gates will not be shut. This is what he says to Cyrus 100 years before he's born. I will go before you and make the rough places smooth. I will shatter the doors of bronze and cut through their iron bars. I will give you the treasures of darkness and hidden wealth of secret places so that you may know that it is I, the Lord, that God of Israel, who calls you by your name for the sake of who? Of Jacob, my servant. And Israel, my chosen one, I have also called you by your name. I have given you a title of honor, though you have not known me. I know you, Cyrus. You don't know me. But guess what? I am controlling the events in your life. I'm going to control your decisions because I'm going to use you because I love Jacob. And I'm going to use you to set my people free. I am Adonai. There is nothing else besides me. There is no God. That's a powerful passage, and it goes on. So just like Abimelech is used of God, has no idea. We see Cyrus used of God, has no idea. Now, why am I talking about Cyrus? Because it was Cyrus who just got this bright idea. I'm going to send the Jews back to Jerusalem, back to Israel. I'm going to end this exile. We've had them for 70 years. It's been wonderful. Nice knowing you. But you can go home now. Not only that, I want you to rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild your temple, rebuild the walls, and here's some money to do it. Cyrus thought that was his idea. It wasn't. It was God. So you see God operating in Cyrus in a big way, the way he's operating in Abimelech in a small way. And in Ezra 1:1, this is what it says. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of Adonai by the mouth of Jeremiah, Adonai stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. This is 100 years later, after what we read in Isaiah. So that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put in writing, saying, and goes on. talks about Cyrus and the decree, go home, you Jewish people. You've served your 70 years in exile. The exile's over. You can go home now. Amazing, isn't it? So, again, what are we doing? We looked at Sarah and Abraham in Egypt and how God dealt with Pharaoh. We saw the first exile in Egypt, how God dealt with Pharaoh. And then we saw Abraham and Sarah in Gerar with Abimelech, and the bride is taken, and how God dealt with Abimelech. And I believe that was prophetic of how God would deal with a second exile in Babylon and how we'd work with Cyrus. But now we come to this chapter. How is the bride revealed to Abimelech here? Well, let's read on. So we're back in Genesis 26. Abimelech is thinking, okay, this is Isaac's sister. He must have been thinking, now didn't his dad say the same thing about his wife? I wonder. But anyways, he didn't take Rebekah from Isaac. It's just some of the men of the city were asking about her. But then it says in verse 8, and it came to pass, as his days there lengthened, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, gazed down through the window and saw, behold, Isaac was jesting with his wife Rebekah. I like how the King James puts it. It says, Isaac was sporting with his wife Rebekah. Like he's hitting her some grounders or something. But he's sporting, you know, what are they doing? Playing basketball, ping pong. But the way it reads in the Hebrew is, he saw, behold, the hine Yitzchak mazechik. Isaac, whose name means laughter, was laughing with his wife. But everybody knew exactly what was going on. They were acting like a husband and a wife should act in private without somebody looking out the window and seeing them. And so what does Abimelech say? Abimelech summoned Isaac and said, but look, she's your wife. That's not your sister. I mean, if it's your sister, we got real problems. But no, this is your wife. How could you say she's my sister? Isaac said to him, because I said that I would be killed because of her. Abimelech said, what is this you have done to us? One of the people has nearly lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. So how was it Abimelech came to realize that the bride, in this case, is indeed a bride? She saw the affection and the love between the husband and the wife, between the bride and the bridegroom, between Rebekah and Isaac. Okay? That's how. Israel is now in their third exile. It's sometimes called the Roman exile because it was when Rome came and ransacked Jerusalem and drove so many of the Jews out of Israel, and they've been in exile for the last 2,000 years. But I think the day is coming when the whole world will realize this people is really a bride. And how will they know? They're going to see the affection between the son of the father and his bride. The world doesn't realize it yet. The world, as this exile continues, the world still thinks that Israel, they're just whatever. They don't belong to anybody. But I think the day is coming, and it's happening in our lifetimes, where the bride, Israel, and we're grafted into Israel. Remember, Israel's not grafted into the Gentile church. Gentile believers are grafted into Israel. That's how we become part of the bride. And I think the day is coming, and it's happening now, when the world's begin to see God's love for the people of Israel and their love for God. And more specifically, their love for the son. Just like Rebekah loved the son, Isaac, the son of Abraham. There's a love of the Jewish people for the son of God, Yeshua. And the world is starting to take notice. If they'll just look out the window. So I think this is prophetic of a day that we're living in and is also approaching, and the fullness of it's right around the corner. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I don't think so. I think the parallels are just too clear. Well, you know, we go on down in chapter 26, And Abimelech in verse 11 says, Abimelech then warned all the people, saying, whoever molests this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Isaac sowed in that land, and in that year he reaped 100-fold. Thus had Adonai blessed him. The man became great and kept becoming greater until he was very great. He had acquired flocks and herds and many enterprises, and the Philistines envied him. All the wells that his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines stopped up and filled them with earth. Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you have become much mightier than we. So Isaac departed from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac dug anew the wells of water which he had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, and the Philistines had stopped up after Abraham's death. And he called them by the same names that his father had called them. These wells, these sources of water that Abraham had dug, and Isaac had to go now and redig. I think there's a great picture here for us. I think on a small scale, if you were raised in a godly home by godly parents, you drank from their wells when you were a child. But now that you're an adult, you need to redig them yourself. You need to redig them yourself. You need to do the work that they did. You don't, it's like they say, God has children, but he has no grandchildren. Because you can't just inherit your faith from your parents. It's okay while you're a child, you can piggyback. But at some time along the way, it must become your faith. It has become your faith. You must take ownership of it. And a word to parents, when you see your kids starting to question everything you believe, don't freak out. They're learning to take ownership of their faith. They're realizing the faith that they've been believing, that's yours. Now they have to go through the work of building their own, taking ownership of their own faith. Don't freak out. If your kids never question, if they never go through that process, I think they might be spiritually weak for most of the rest of their lives. Because they've never done the work that you did. But I think on a greater scale, we have to ask, what are the wells that Abraham dug? Well, we're already told earlier in the chapter, we read it, when God speaks to Isaac, he talks about all the blessings that comes Isaac's way because Abraham, he obeyed my voice. He observed my safeguards. He kept my commandments, my decrees, my Torahs. And so it's like we need to do the same thing. And what was so pure and thirst-quenching to the past generation and to our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, and Moses, and Joshua, and David, and Samuel, and all these wonderful giants of the scriptures, we need to go back and redig the same wells. Yeshua talks about building a house. And in Luke, he says, the wise man digs down and builds his house on the rock. We've got to dig down, build our house on the rock. We need to dig down for the living water. And that's, I think, a lesson for us that we all need to do. All right, I see a hand up finally. So let's get a microphone over here to Jim. Wherever the microphone may be. Okay, it's coming over your head, Jason, right there. All right, great. It looks like you're our runner this morning. Right here. Jim, raise your hand. There you are. I mean, if we're good enough, we can just toss this across the sanctuary and you catch it, right? Okay, yes, go ahead, Jim.
This is the example of Cyrus showing that God uses a natural man as a rebuilding man.
God uses everybody. That's why he's God. He uses everything. The question is how is he going to use you? He can use you as an example of how things shouldn't be done, or you can follow him and he can use you as an example of how things should be done. He can use an example of disobedience or of obedience. In Cyrus's case, it's just an example of God's sovereignty. He uses him. God sets up kings and takes down kings. He sets up presidents, takes down presidents, because he is sovereign. Whether that king or president knows it or not is beside the point. Now, if we know God and we surrender to him. We say, Father, use me as you will. And he says, now that is an instrument. I can do great things with that person. He'll use you in any way. It makes no difference. He uses everybody and everything. Because he's the Lord of all the earth. All the earth. Yeah, that's how big he is. And Steve, yes?
When Josiah was king, Pharaoh, Pharaoh Necro, was going to do a battle. And Josiah went up to me and he said, your God told me to destroy these people.
Yeah.
Don't be involved. He did, and he caused his death.
Yeah.
But God was speaking directly to Pharaoh, talking to Josiah.
Good point. Good point. We can find all kinds of examples where God is just working, doing things. I mean, the way he used Pharaoh. He raised up Pharaoh to do exactly what he did in the days of the Exodus. And Tom, your hand was up next. Let's go to Tom here. Let's bring, yeah, right over here. There's Tom.
I don't really understand, like Abraham and Isaac, when they told these people that their wives were their sisters.
Yeah.
They more or less knew that these people were going to take them and do things with them. And it seemed to me like they were okay with that.
Yeah. I know. That's why I'm not talking about that, because I don't get it either. That's the best answer I know for you, the best response I know. Yeah, it does make sense. And each one of them was concerned about their own life, not about their wife. Yeah, so it's, yeah, it's just very odd. I don't get that. But that's why I think God put these here, not so we talk about the husbands. He wants us to look at the bride instead. And when I shifted my focus away from Abraham and Isaac and looked over at Sarah and Rebecca, it's like, oh, now this story comes out. Now this story comes out. I will say this, though. In each case, if I'm reading this right, and Sarah and Rebecca represent us, we have to remember the wedding has not taken place yet. We call ourselves the bride of Messiah. Well, not yet. We're the fiancé, but not the bride. We are in a position of kedushim. We are betrothed. But the wedding hasn't taken place yet. And just as Hebrews talks about how Messiah came so that he could bring many brothers, it talks about the brothers that he brings in. I guess we could call ourselves sisters in the spiritual sense as well. So in one sense, we're not exactly the bride yet. And maybe that's why God is doing this, because he wants us to see this is your condition, the turmoil you go through here. But once the bridegroom comes, once the wedding actually takes place, he says, I'll be with you forever, you'll be with me forever, you know, and there's never going to be a separation between us. So if you followed all that, I'm very proud of you, and you can explain it to me later. Okay, and Adam's hands up here.
Just one thought I have, but obviously I think everybody wrestles with these, and I think to how Messiah is referred to as the final Adam, or you know, the true Adam, and how he lived out and did everything that Adam did wrong, he did it correctly.
Yes, right.
And I think that we can almost see in that analogy continuing through Scripture of saying, look, the areas where Abraham messed up, the areas where Isaac messed up, you know, the areas where all the forefathers messed up, in this era I will go correct. So
yeah.
He's not going to abandon us.
That's right.
And say we're justice.
Yes. I'll never leave you or forsake you, he says.
But
yeah.
I see a little bit of that when I look at these examples are here for us to look and also compare the difference between what man does and what Messiah does.
Good point. Good point. Yeah. Yeah, he's not ashamed to call us his brothers, but he's not ashamed to take us as a bride. That just floors me. That just absolutely floors me. It's amazing. Amazing how gracious he is. All right, one more comment. We're going to go with Carla over here, and then we're going to move on because the best is yet ahead.
We struggle with this stuff because we're imposing our culture. And
that's true.
This is the way it was back then. Yeah. Nobody questioned it. Yeah. The divine right of kings that went all the way up through Europe. I mean, remember Braveheart?
Sure.
It was still going on. This is no big deal to anybody back then.
Yeah.
It's just the way it was.
Yeah.
But we, how could that happen? And it's like it happened because that's what it was. So when we see these women
that's right.
as the plot drivers all the way through the word, and I relationship. Mm-hmm. And we scratch our head about SOTA, and we don't understand. Whenever women are introduced to this big mystery, it's because this is how the story
yes.
of creation moves forward, and this is the only way we're going to get there.
That's
so
right.
Just remember, women are driving this entire
yeah.
story.
That's true.
It's already done.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So well put. Great insight. And also, as you talk about the women driving the story, it's because when you see the story of these women, it's our story. It's our story. So we are, yeah. Thank you. Those are all wonderful comments, remarks. But we have, there are going to be more. We're going to generate more here. So I want to leave time for these other things. And I'm sure you're going to have a lot of other questions and comments. As we go through these wells now, it says, verse 19, Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of fresh water. The herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours. You can have the whole, but the water belongs to us," that sort of thing. So he called the name of that well Esek, because they involved themselves with him. Now, the word Esek means contention, oppression, tyranny. Doesn't that sound like Egypt? And then they dug another well. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that also. So he called his name Sitna. Sitna actually is where we get the word Satan. Those first three letters right there spell the word Satan, Satan, because it means to accuse. It means to stand against. And what it says, that what's interesting, the name of this well is not directly connected to one of the verbs as it's with Esek. In the previous verse, it says they called the well Esek because there they Eseked with him. Okay? But when they, in verse 21, they dug another well and they quarreled, that's the word reave, they reaved over that. So they called it Sitna. The name of the well and the verb that generated the name aren't connected. But I think, again, the Holy Spirit's given us a hint. Because if you look at Jeremiah 50, 33 to 34 in the Hebrew, this is what it says. It's talking about the Babylonian exile. It says, "Thus says Adonai of hosts, the sons of Israel are oppressed." And that is the word Esek, by the way. "And the sons of Judah as well, and all who took them captive have held them fast. They have refused to let them go. But their Redeemer is strong. Adonai of hosts is his name. He will vigorously plead their case so that he may bring rest to the earth, but turmoil to the inhabitants of Babylon." Now that phrase, vigorously plead their case, listen to it. And it is reev, yariv, et rivam. Use the word reev three times. Talking about what God's going to do to Babylon. Babylon's overthrown. Persia takes over. Cyrus raises up. And God uses Cyrus now to let them go. So that word reeve in our verse is used three times in relation to Babylon in Jeremiah 50, 33 to 34. But what happens with the third well? He relocated, verse 22, from there and dug another well. They did not quarrel over it. So he called its name Rehovot. Rehovot. This is where we get the name Rahab. Rahab is the name Rahab. Remember Rahab? Over in Joshua chapter 2 and chapter 6. Means wide, spacious, enlarged, Rahav. Which I don't know. I don't know if that's speaking of Rahab's physiognomy there or not. I don't know. But that was her name. But I love this legend in Judaism. It's not in the scriptures, but it's a legend that Rahab became Joshua's wife. Rahab the harlot. Rahab the harlot. She had faith. And she extended great courage and openness to the spies that came into Jericho. And so Joshua spared her and her family. And tradition says she became his wife. Kind of like Isaac and Rebekah. Doesn't the name Rehovot and the name Rivka even sound similar? I just think there are connections here that, again, these wells may be once again picturing prophetically these three exiles and how they turn out. Well, as I was studying this week, I stumbled across something that I think is a pretty cool discovery. I was thinking about Abraham made a covenant with Abimelech back in chapter 21. And then here, Isaac makes a covenant with Abimelech. Let's take a look. Let's go on down to verse 26. Abimelech went to him, to Isaac, from Gerar with a group of his friends and Phicol, general of his legion. And back when Abimelech made this covenant with Abraham, many chapters earlier, we find his general, Phicol, also with him. Isaac said to him, "Why have you come to me? You hate me and drove me away from you." They said, "We have indeed seen that Adonai has been with you." So we said, "Let the oath between ourselves now be between us and you. And let us make a covenant with you. If you do evil with us, just as we have not molested you, and just as we have done with you only good, and sent you away in peace, now you, O blessed of Adonai." He made them a feast, and they ate and drank. They woke early in the morning and swore to one another. Then Isaac saw them off. They departed from him in peace. It was on that very day that Isaac's servants came and told him about the well that they had dug. And they said to him, "We have found water." And he named it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba until this very day. Guess the name of the place where Abraham and Abimelech had a covenant. Anybody remember the name of that place? It was Beersheba also. Same Beersheba as far as we know. But this is what got me thinking. When I went back and read about Abraham's covenant with Abimelech, I noticed that right before that event, it describes Ishmael taking a wife. It's just two verses, chapter 21, verses 20-21. Just says Ishmael got married. Well, what takes place here after this covenant at Beersheba? Look at verse 34. When Esau was 40 years old, he took a wife. So we see this covenant with Abraham, between Abimelech and Abraham, with General Phicol and company at Beersheba. We see the same thing happening with Isaac. But right before Abraham has his covenant, Ishmael takes a wife. Right after Isaac makes a covenant with the same person, with Abimelech, Esau takes a wife. So it got me thinking. I wonder if this menorah pattern keeps going out. If there are things between chapter 21 and 26 and things before and after 21 and 26. So here's the list of events. Just in order. Ishmael takes a wife. There's a covenant with Abimelech. There's an altar built and God renews his promise with Abraham. There's negotiation over land because Sarah died and Abraham negotiates to buy Machpelah in the cave. A bride is found for Isaac in chapter 24. Abraham dies in chapter 25. And then we're given Ishmael's genealogy. Then there's the death of Ishmael. Then we're given Isaac's genealogy. Then there's a dispute over Isaac's bride. There's a negotiation over water. God renews his promise and an altar is built. There's a covenant with Abimelech, and then Esau takes a wife. If you put them in a menorah pattern, it comes out like this. It begins and ends with Ishmael and Esau, each taking a wife. We saw the covenants with Abimelech, which is letter B. And see, there's an altar and God renews his promise. And down here, God renews his promise, then there's an altar. In chapter 23, there's a negotiation over land. But in chapter 26, we just read, there's a negotiation over water. In chapter 24, find a bride for Isaac, but the counterpart on the menorah is there's a dispute over Isaac's bride. Then in the middle, in this section here, and this is not unusual when you find these menorah patterns in Scripture. If you listen to Rabbi David Foreman's teachings on Aleph Beta, which is a wonderful site, wonderful teachings, he's always discovering menorah patterns, and you'll often find those menorah patterns, it breaks down right in the middle and then has this repetitive pattern. And if you're listening, you can't see this. You just need to get the notes online when you get home from driving to work or whatever, and you can see how this fits. These four middle parts are this: death of Abraham, Ishmael's genealogy. Death of Ishmael, Isaac's genealogy. So it goes like A, B, A, B. In fact, it says, it has the same words. Ve'ela toldot in chapter 25, verse 12. Ve'ela toldot, and these are the generations of Ishmael. And then in chapter 25, 19, Ve'ela toldot, and these are the generations of Isaac. Now, why does God do menorah patterns? Well, a couple reasons. One is that you see there's always harmony and sovereignty in the way God orchestrates historic events. But more importantly, it points towards the middle. It tells us what the focus of all these stories is. When you have a menorah, it's always easy to see what's in the middle, right? And what's in the middle holds up everything. Everybody with me? So when you find these menorah patterns covering, in this case, six chapters of Scripture from 21 to chapter 26, as we move into the middle, we find out what really it's all about. And when you look at this, you'll notice that everything here in the middle is from chapter 25. Everything here is from chapter 25, starting with chapter 25, verse 1, ending with 25:34. Everything is from chapter 25, the chapter we studied last week. We also find here in this middle section, in chapter 25, we find all the major players. We find Abraham, we find Ishmael, we find Isaac, and who else? Who else? I know it's been a whole 7 days. Jacob and Esau. Because when it gives the genealogy of Isaac, it just starts going right on through into the birth of Jacob and Esau, because that's his genealogy. But it pauses and slows down. It's like God says, I'm not just going to give you the names of his kids. I want you to see how his kids came to be, these twin brothers wrestling inside Rebecca's womb. This is important. Focus your attention here, because this is what the whole story is about. And what's the whole story about? The war that goes on in each of us between our flesh and our spirit, between our nefesh and our neshama, between the one that pulls us one direction and the one that pulls us to the other direction, and this warfare and the promise God makes that the older, the fleshly one, the Esau nature in us will eventually serve the younger one, the Jacob nature. Remember how Jacob or Esau was all red and hairy? He was a man of the field. He liked to trap and hunt and kill and eat. Arr. But Jacob, on the other hand, was smooth. And he dwelt in tents. He's not a man of the field. He dwelt in tents because he wanted to study with his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham. So let's focus in on this. This is what the book of Genesis is really all about. In fact, this is kind of what the whole Bible is really all about. And what's the heart of this menorah? So I want you to memorize what you see here on the screen. It's not that tough. Whenever you think of Abraham, just in your mind, also say Isaac, Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Do it right now. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Always put the three together. These are ha'avot. These are the fathers. Whenever in the New Testament you read about the fathers, it's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not just one, all three. Isaac's name means laughter. Because laughter is what connects two things that don't belong. Laughter is what happens when there's incongruity. And if you want to see incongruity, compare Abraham's life with Jacob's life. They could not be more opposite. They simply could not be more opposite. In fact, God changed Abram's name from Abram to Abraham, right? He added one letter. Changed Abram to Abraham. God also changed Yaakov to Israel. How did he do that? By adding a letter? No, by getting rid of all the letters but one and replacing all the rest. He kept the Yud, he kept the first letter of Yaakov. All the rest of the letters went and replaced them, so it became Yisrael. Abraham didn't have many struggles in his life. He was tested, but he was wealthy. Things went smoothly. He just had a real hard time having kids. Jacob, it was just rough from day one. He spent over 20 years working for Laban because he fell in love with Rachel. He gets the wrong bride, gets her ugliest, or Leah, and then he has to work another 7 years for Rachel. Then he gets two more wives, and every time he looks at one of them, they get pregnant and have a baby. 12 sons. We don't know how many daughters. But just kids, I mean, just explosion. Exact opposite of Abraham. But boy, it was rough. God calls Abraham out of a foreign country to Israel to stay. Jacob is born in that holy land, but then has to go out to be dealt with by God. But Isaac, laughter, is what takes the two opposites and unites them. That's what laughter does. You laugh. Things are funny. We know psychologically things are funny because you take two things that don't belong. And when you put them together in a unique way, it's funny. You just laugh. You just do. You're wanting some examples, don't you? I'm not in a laughing mood, so we're just going to move on. But, I mean, just right there. All right? That's not what you expected me to say. It was this really stupid remark I made, but it got a little bit of laughter anyhow. It's just incongruous. That's the way it is. You talk about real incongruity? I'll tell you real incongruity. A woman and a man. There's nothing more incongruous than that. It's not just the biology is different. Different species. Different species. You know, there's a book out, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus or something like that. I wouldn't have put them in the same galaxy myself. They're so different, and it's wonderful. But when Abimelech looked out the window and he saw Isaac and Rebekah, what were they doing? Laughing. He saw Yitzchak, Mitzbeach, okay? That's not the right word. He saw Isaac, what's the right Hebrew word? Yitzchak. Matzachek. It's the same word. He saw laughter, laughing, because they were together as a husband and a wife. Do you understand? That's incongruous, but it causes laughter, causes joy when opposites come together as they should. Now, Isaac had a half-brother, Ishmael. And remember, Ishmael was older. Ishmael had a different mother. Ishmael's mother was Egyptian, it was Hagar, but the father was Abraham, and there was friction between them. Because Ishmael was persecuting Isaac, so Sarah goes to her husband Abraham and says, send out this woman and her son, get him out of here. Abraham didn't want to. He goes before the Lord. The Lord says, listen to your wife Sarah, do what she says. So he sent them packing. Jacob and Esau were twins. Twins. They shared their mother's womb at the same time. Esau is born first, Jacob second, as we're going to see in the next chapter of Genesis next week. Esau wanted to kill Jacob. He wanted to murder him. He says, as soon as Father Isaac is dead, so are you. I'm going to kill you. Jacob did not want to kill Esau, his twin brother. What do these represent? And later on, we see Ishmael and Esau connected. Because over in Genesis 28, verse 9, it says, and Esau went to Ishmael and married, besides the wives that he had, Mahalat, the daughter of Ishmael. Esau and Ishmael intermarried. They're kind of the same substance. They're kind of the same spirit, the same essence. So, if you recall, several weeks ago, I asked you the question, why do we have two stories? Why do we need a story about Ishmael, and why do we need a story about Esau? Do you remember the answer?
12 nations.
No, it doesn't have to do with the 12 nations. I mean, Ishmael did have 12 sons, and Jacob had 12 sons, and they each became their own separate nations. Okay, and we'll remind you, because this is the heart of the menorah. This is the key to everything. Maybe it'll come back to you when I repeat it. Are you listening? Everybody with me?
Yes.
If your neighbor's dozing, this is a good time to elbow him, wake him up. And then after this, they can go back to sleep and meditate. The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. We all have a Yetzer Hara, an evil inclination. But there are two Yetzer Haras I have to deal with. I have to deal with your Yetzer Hara, and I have to deal with my Yetzer Hara. And the way I deal with yours is completely different from the way I deal with mine. To me, your Yetzer Hara is like Ishmael. We're not really all that close. We're really not all that close. And how did Isaac deal with Ishmael? Because remember, Ishmael was persecuting Isaac. How did Isaac deal with that? How did he deal with it? He didn't. He let his father deal with it. He took a passive stance. He was just a little kid anyway at the time. And Abraham took Ishmael and sent him away and got him out of Isaac's life. When it comes to your Yetzer Hara, that is how I roll. Father, I'm just going to have to put up with the things that people say and people do, because they're your kids, not mine. You're the one to discipline and take charge of them, not me. That's how I deal with your Yetzer Hara. Now, there are some small exceptions to this. When a person is invited into your life or has authority in your life, then they can begin to speak to your Yetzer Hara. Like if you have kids, your parents can help deal with your Yetzer Hara because they have authority. If you come to me and say, Grant, there's something I'm really struggling with, will you help me? Then you're inviting me to come in. As a shepherd of this flock, if I see your Yetzer Hara causing damage to others, sheep should not bite, then I might have to step in and say, hey, you know what? We don't do that here. Just kind of move along. Because there's an area of authority there. Other than that, your Yetzer Hara is between you and God. But my Yetzer Hara, that's my Esau. We're twins. We came into being at exactly the same time. But we do not see eye to eye on anything. Nothing. And if people look at us, my Yetzer HaTov, my Yetzer Hara, they say, they have nothing in common. You'd be exactly right. And how did Jacob deal with Esau? How did Jacob deal with Esau? Did he send Esau away? Uh-uh. He sent Jacob away. When God dealt with Jacob, and when Jacob finally became Israel, then Esau and Israel unite. They embrace, they wept on one another, and the gifts that God had given Jacob flowed then back to Esau. See, this Esau, this is my nephesh. This is the flesh. This is the left side of my soul. This is the part of my soul that's interested in the world and in the flesh and in physical stuff. Jacob, this is my neshama. Remember from last week? This is the part of me that's interested with things on the right and the spiritual side. But when God deals with this, and when it becomes completely yielded to him, and I learn to walk in that, I learn to walk in the spirit, I do not fulfill the lust of the nephesh. You see? The lust of the flesh. When I can finally move from a Jacob, which means heel, and become a Yisrael, which means straight with God, or straight toward God, or prince of God, when I can become that, when I can move from this to this, this is no longer a problem over here. It's dealt with. See, trying to beat up your flesh and you know, what's that? They flagellate. They take that. I'd be careful what word I use there. Flagellate. When they whip themselves, oh, I'm so sinful flesh, and they're beating themselves up and starving themselves. That doesn't really accomplish much. In fact, that itself can be a fleshly act. What you do is you learn to walk in the Spirit. If you walk in the Spirit, you will not fulfill the desires of the flesh. Period. And what happens is your nephesh becomes the servant. What was the prophecy God spoke to Rebekah when these two are wrestling in her womb? He told her, there are two peoples, two regimes are inside of you, but the power will pass from the older to the younger, and the younger will rule over the older. Won't be that way at first, but that's how it ends. That's what the whole story is about. And that's why when you look at the menorah, everything's pointing to chapter 25. It's pointing to all the major players. And we learn what Abraham learned. What Abraham learned is displayed in the life of Jacob. And what God does with Ishmael, what God does with Esau, what God is using Isaac for, all of these things come together in this marvelous, amazing story, which isn't just history, it's your story and it's my story. This is what the entire Bible is about, right here. It's all right here. If we can learn to read it, learn to meditate and think on it, and when we run into this headbutting between our flesh and our spirit, or maybe tug of war is a better way to describe it, they want to pull opposite directions. If we can learn the lessons here, we're going to do okay. We're going to do better than okay. We're going to win this battle. And we're going to become an Israel and not just a heel. A grasper. Instead of just grasping, we're going to learn to wait upon the Lord who will give. And when does it come to a head? There's another wrestling match ahead for Jacob we'll be getting to. When he wrestles with God himself and wins. When you win that war, Esau, small potatoes. Esau and I can embrace because he's now mine. You understand? I can't emphasize enough, folks, how vitally important this story is. This schematic, the lessons it teaches. Go over it and over it and over it and chew on it and memorize it and read it again, read it forwards, read it backwards, rehearse it in your mind. Ask God to reveal to you the dynamics of the story because they're exactly what's happening in every single one of our lives right now. And until the day we die, this is the dynamic. These are the relationships and the struggles that go on within every single one of us. I just simply can't stress it enough. I don't know of anything I've ever taught, I've ever had to try to stress as much as this right here, the heart of this menorah pattern, because that is what it's all about. Everything is about that. Did I stress it enough for you? You get the point. Am I coming across? Okay, who has the microphone? Okay, I don't know which order the hands came up, Steve, so I'm going to let you just pass it where you want. Min, we'll start with Min.
Man, this is so much.
There's a lot here. You're right.
Again, what I see here about the flesh will eventually be our servants because we are tuggling between the two. I had a verse that came to my mind. It's in 2 Corinthians 1 and chapter 1, verse 3.
Okay.
This is amazing of how God is that we will, in the end, we will end up praising him when finally, you know, our flesh becomes our servant. But right yes. now, brother Dion said, we are at the progress. Every day, yeah. you see this happening in the end. This verse said, praise be to God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort. Who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those who are in trouble with the comfort that we have received.
Yes.
So our struggle and our trial can be used by God to comfort others.
Absolutely.
I wish I lived that way all the time. But, yeah. you know, but that is the goal, isn't it?
Well, let me give you some comfort right here. When did Jacob have all of his children? After he had spent 20 years with Uncle Laban, 20 years, 14 of those years, trying to win these two wives, one he wanted, one he didn't. After he had the wrestling match with God, when did the children come along? All during those 20 years. Before he had that wrestling match with God and was restored to Esau, he had had 11 sons. And Rachel was pregnant with number 12, Benjamin. So even though you're going through struggles, there's great fruitfulness going on. Tremendous fruitfulness. So it's not like God's waiting for perfection, waiting until he finally reaches us. Now I can finally start using you for something. No. The moment he left Esau and began to pursue God, the fruitfulness started. It just started. So that's a great comfort to me. That he doesn't have to wait till I'm perfect to use me, or I would never get used. I would never get used. Okay, and Jim, yes, go right ahead.
All believers are the body of Yeshua, even including here at the Coon.
Yeah, I hope so.
When you're the body, how do you differ, separate from the bride, or what do you have to do that? Even though you are body, how do you become bride? Well, I ask this question just so you correct my thinking. I thought it was the same.
Okay, no, they're not the same. I'm glad you... of course, it depends on how you use the term body. Remember, God is a father, and he has a father's love for everybody. His love for everybody is completely indiscriminate. Just like you as parents, you love all your kids the same, whether they're talented or not, or good-looking or not, or sports heroes or not, tall or short, whatever, you love them all the same because they're your kids. That's the Father's love for everybody. But God also has a special kind of love that a man has for one person, for the wife. And that's a love that's earned. I didn't pick Robin just by... just going through the phone book and pointing to a name. Oh, that's I guess that's the one. I don't want to play favorites. No, there was something about her that just made something light up inside of me that nobody else did. I loved her humor. I still do. I love her humor. I love the things she loves, except for broccoli and asparagus. And, I mean, it's just out of all the women, and there's wonderful women here, she's the one. She's the one I picked. And so the bride are those people. And one of the reasons I love her is because she loves me. And she picked me, made me love her even more. So there's a special kind of love God, the bridegroom, has for the bride. But that's very, very discriminatory. It discriminates between everyone else and those who love him back and set themselves apart and do the things that please him. And it's like, yes, that's my bride. I love everybody. They're all my kids. But this one's my bride. So there are two different kinds of love God has. And we need to make sure we differentiate between the two. So yeah, God loves me. He loves the whole world. But I want to be part of those that love him back in such a way he says, yeah, I pick you. So we can all be part of that bride, but it's up to us. It's really up to us to be the kind of people who love him in such a way we do what pleases him. We model our lives on that day when he'll come back for us. It controls everything we do. That's the bride. Okay, Sharon.
You know, the last couple of weeks, you've put together some word pictures and when you think about things in a way, one of the questions that came up earlier was, why did these patriarchs, these men, our spiritual fathers, blow it so badly when it came to women in their lives? And Carly, your comment about women driving the entire story of the scriptures, my brain just slipped back to last week with the two hula hoops.
Yeah.
And a comment that has been made a couple times in the last couple of weeks about the older we get, the easier it is to become so much more comfortable with the spiritual side of our life as we get less and less encumbered with the fleshly part that just doesn't seem to matter so much anymore. As you start to be dealing with more difficult issues, that, you know, if there's something you can do to change them, it just is.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And I also think that it must be difficult for physical men to wrap their mind around the fact that the spiritual is more feminine. Maybe that's easier for women to click into this a little bit better. But what I'm seeing is that the goal for all of us is to, you know, enhance and develop that spiritual neshama side of ourselves as much as possible, because that's the bride. And I went back after you reminded Peter with this question to go back a couple of years to say for all.
Yeah.
And I'm almost now seeing that this love you're talking about, the love that the Father has for those of us who he has this unique connection with as the betrothed, you know, we're the ones that are going to be blessed.
Yeah.
The ones that haven't made that connection, that's where a little bit of the punishment comes, but it all works out.
A lot of consequences.
In the end, because he is love.
Yes.
So for me, you know, it's wonderful to hear two people here today talking about people being brought into the kingdom.
Yeah.
You know, because now there's another person who's going to be a bride.
Yes.
And, you know, my hope for all of us is that we can extend the tent pegs to those we love around us so that they're the bride also.
Yes. Good point.
But I can't thank you enough for what you've been feeding us.
Oh,
like,
well.
This is.
I'm just glad to be able to get it off my brain for a while, just share it. So thank you, Sharon, so much. You know what? Our time is almost 10 after. I tell you what, I saw Ben's hand shooting up there very enthusiastically a moment ago. So we're going to go to Ben with first, and then we'll come back to Peter, and then we'll close.
I shouldn't have raised my hand. But,
too late now, buddy.
I was just going to say, the farther I go walking towards God, it seems like the more active I have a choice of doing right or wrong.
Yes.
And I have experienced more discipline now than before I knew.
Of course.
Which is good. I've learned.
Yeah.
So she said something, and I was like, wait, I'm feeling more discipline now.
Yeah, that's
I
true.
I have learned now to be thankful for it.
Yeah. But nothing good comes as life without discipline. So it's all good stuff. It really is. Thank you, Ben, for sharing. And Peter will give you the last word.
Thank you, Grant. As always, I really appreciate the teachings.
Thank you.
My question is on the well. The well that the three wells and the Yisra, the evil inclination.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in digging the well, we have to dig our own well.
Yes.
But in looking at the yes and the right, which you said, we have to take care of our neighbors and our own neighboring nation. Now, how can we reconcile those? Is there a trend in that? Because if in digging the well, I just have to take care of my own well.
Yeah.
But why should I also now take care when it comes to the evil inclination of my neighbor? Why can't I take care of my
own? that's a good question. Yeah, I don't have to take care of my neighbor's Yetzer Hara. That's his job. But he can come drink from my well anytime he wants. Okay? He can do that. So we're going to be an overflowing source of living water to people. So we could share the water with people. But when it comes to correcting them and so on, I have very, very limited rights. Very limited rights. The scriptures let me know when I can step in and speak up and do something. But generally, I pray for those people, and I'm gracious to them. I give them space for God to work in their lives. But they can come drink from my well whenever they want. They have to dig their own, but they can drink from mine. But speaking of re-digging wells, which would be easier, digging the original well or re-digging the same well? Re-digging. The hard work's been done. And redigging the well is much easier than having to dig it for the first time. So I thank God for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all these godly men, our forefathers, who did the digging. Redigging it now is much easier for us, but we still have to do the work. All right? So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time. Lord, there's so much to discuss, so much to learn, so much to see here. So continue to open our eyes, our hearts, and minds to these truths that are held in this incredible book, your Torah, in the book of Genesis, and especially right there in chapter 25. Lord, help us to be people who walk in the Spirit and not in the flesh. People who are spiritually minded and not carnally minded. And help us not to be soulish people either, who just walk on our own emotions, walk on our own pride of life. But Lord, are truly led by your word, by your Spirit, by what is right, what is true, what is light, what is good, what is like Yeshua. Help us to be the people who bear your name well. And may people see us and recognize that we are your kids because we bear your resemblance. Make us those kinds of people, Father. We ask in Yeshua's precious name. Amen.